Okay, so I'm going to talk about the origin of some of the large planetary satellites in our solar system and try, in keeping with the theme of this conference, to say a few things about what the origin of these objects may tell us about the more general process of planet formation. So there are two basic mechanisms that are believed to be responsible for the majority of the large planetary satellites. In an impact-triggered scenario, the collision between two solid objects results in the injection of material into bound orbit around the larger of the two objects, and from that material, a satellite can then coalesce. And co-formation proposes that a satellite forms essentially alongside a planet, for example, within an accretion disk of gas and dust that might exist during the final stages of a giant planet accretion. So if we look at the large satellites around the traditionally defined planets, and I'll keep Pluto defined as a planet for the purpose of this talk. I do work for Alan Stern, so that's a wise approach. We see that around the solid planets, we have two large satellites, of course, our Moon and Pluto's Charon. These objects are both quite massive compared to their central primaries, and they're both commonly believed to be a result of large impacts. Around the gas giants, we have systems of multiple large satellites, but these objects contain a much smaller fraction of their central planet's mass. And around the ice giants, it's a bit of a mixed bag. The Uranian satellites may have been a result of either a co-formation situation or perhaps as a result of a Uranus tilting impact. And the large satellite of Neptune, Triton, was probably a result of capture. So in this talk, I'm going to say a few things about the origin of the first three, our Moon, the Pluto-Charon system, and the Galilean satellites of Jupiter. Yes? Well, it depends on what you define. So this is my definition. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be discriminatory to the fifth largest satellite of Uranus. I'll start by talking a little bit about some recent results on the origin of the Moon. If one believes that the Moon-forming impact was the primary source of the angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system, then the current system constrains the set of impact parameters associated with the Moon-forming impact, specifically a combination of four parameters: the size of the impactor relative to the target or the total mass, the impact velocity, the total mass in the collision, and what I'll call the normalized impact parameter B, or the sine of the impact angle. And you can tell from this expression that if you need to account for the Earth-Moon system angular momentum with a single impact, you need a relatively oblique collision by an object that contains on the order of 10% of the Earth's mass or more. We also know a lot about the Moon, namely that it's very depleted in iron, so Moon-forming impact has to account for this. And finally, a successful impact also has to give you enough mass and angular momentum in orbit around the Earth to form a Moon outside the Earth's Roche limit. So I'll show you some results of a single example Moon-forming impact simulation. The technique here is SPH. It uses a really highly sophisticated equation of state that was first developed out of Sandia, but has really recently been expanded upon by both Jay Malosh and Betty Perazzo in University of Arizona and the Planetary Science Institute. The simulation I'll show you involves about 60,000 particles, and this corresponds to an initial scale of the particles in the proto-Earth of a few hundred kilometers. And with this kind of resolution, at the end of the simulation, you're able to resolve a lunar mass that contains about 1% of an Earth mass with a few thousand SPH particles. So the specific case I'll show you involves a total mass and angular momentum in the collision, very similar to that of the current Earth-Moon system. So this is implying that the Moon-forming impact occurred near the very end of Earth's accretion. And the impactor is just a little over the mass of Mars. It's hitting at the escape velocity of the two colliding objects with about a 45-degree impact angle. Okay, I'm going to kneel here. All right, so this is an animation of the impact. I'll play it through a couple times. The temperature here is scaling with degrees in Kelvin. The objects were initially assumed to have a temperature of about 2,000 degrees at their surface. And by the end of the impact, most of the material in the Earth has been heated up by several thousand degrees Kelvin. It's actually engulfed by a silicate vapor atmosphere, shown here in red. And the disk material on average is somewhat cooler. It has typical temperatures of 3,000 to 4,000 degrees Kelvin. So if we look back through this a little more slowly, I'll pause at a couple points. After the initial oblique impact, the outer portions of the impactor that grazed past the Earth are stretched out into this long arm of material here. The inner portions will actually rotate ahead of the outer portions. And this provides a configuration for the outer portions to actually receive a positive torque, and this helps them to get lifted into orbit. You'll see that the inner portions of the impactor here actually temporarily recoalesce into a fairly coherent object, which will re-impact the Earth in a moment here. There we go. And this outer clump down here eventually makes a close pass within the Roche limit and is then tidally sheared apart. So at the end of this impact, you're left with a system that's a good analog for one that might form an Earth-Moon system. There's about 1.6 lunar masses in this disk, with a lunar mass having equivalent orbits outside the Earth's Roche limit. So this looks like a good candidate as far as the mass and angular momentum match with our system goes. What about the composition issue? This will be the same simulation, the animated on the left, but here the color is corresponding to material type, with red being iron and orange being the dunite mantles. So these objects are both assumed to be differentiated before the impact. That seems a very reasonable assumption given the size of the impactor, which is Mars size. So what you'll see is that by virtue of the impactor's core being more central, it actually collides with the Earth more directly and stays in a closer, more central orbit to the Earth. And now you can see that that inner clump that's going to recollide with the Earth in a moment is actually primarily composed of the core of the impactor. So when that inner clump hits the Earth, you've essentially removed most of the impactor iron from orbit. So while you start off with objects that are roughly terrestrial in their composition with about 30% iron by mass, at the end of one of these impacts, you've really segregated the iron out of the disk, and you're left with a disk that contains only a few percent iron by mass. So the final animation I'll show you is one that's been, yeah?
This animation also shows that you need to restart the interface of the Earth. The old view that the core was going directly to the heater of the Earth, joining the Earth's core. And the simulations, from what I see, seems to show that the metal of the impactor spreads off the Earth.
Well, unfortunately, well, to some extent, those things are both true. These are 3D simulations, and you're seeing a plotting of all the points. So what you're seeing is the very hot iron that is sitting on top. However, if you do a cross-section, which, and I have a couple figures from my paper here that show this, then you'll see that there is a big fraction of the impactor's core that is falling through the mantle and being incorporated. So to some extent, both of the things that you described are happening. Okay, so here on the right, the color scheme is changed. And this animation is designed to just show you where the material that ends up in the moon came from on these objects. So here, yellow are the particles at the end of the simulation that are in the disk. Blue are the particles defined by their angular momentum to be in the planet. And the red particles are escaping. So these particles will each maintain their identity in this animation. And we're going back in time. And you can see from doing this that the particles that were in the disk, the yellow particles here, come overwhelmingly from a single region of the impactor, mostly the impactor's mantle, that was just radially exterior to that initial impact site. So there seems to be a fairly consistent picture of what type of impact we need to form the specific Earth-Moon system. And there have been a lot of these simulations done. And in addition to showing us that we can form our particular moon, these simulations also suggest more common trends in impact ejection of material during large collisions. And the basic thing that comes out of these collisions is that if you have large collisions where the impactor has a significant fraction of the mass of the target, and the collision is occurring at some velocity near the escape velocity, such as would be typical if you assume you're in an accretionary regime, and the collisions are oblique, then you're going to produce material into orbit. This plot here shows the disk mass and lunar masses for a whole bunch of simulations as a function of the impact parameter. So the impact is becoming more oblique as we move to the right. And these have been done at a variety of impact velocities. Now for this plot, all of the impacts had the same relative size of the impactor to the target that I showed in the last simulation. And so one thing that emerges is that from these results is that generally, as you increase the impact parameter, you tend to get a higher fraction of the total colliding mass placed into orbit. And also, as you vary the relative size of the impactor to the target, as that relative size increases, this whole plot shifts upward. That's another way to increase the fraction of the mass that you place in orbit, is to have a bigger impactor relative to the target. So given this, what about forming a Pluto-Charon type system from an impact? There are two key differences between the Pluto-Charon and the Earth-Moon system. One, as I mentioned earlier, the Charon is about an order of magnitude more massive relative to Pluto than the Moon is to the Earth. And actually, the angular momentum of the Pluto-Charon system is so high that it exceeds the critical angular momentum for rotational stability of a single object that would have the total system mass. So given the results of the moon-forming impacts, what kind of collision might be best able to produce a system like that? Well, as I mentioned, the yield of orbiting material, the fraction of material that you place into orbit, tends to increase as the collision becomes more oblique and as you increase the relative size of the impactor to the target. And by that logic, the way to put the most material into orbit would be to have a collision between like-size objects that's a fairly grazing one. And that's also the type of collision for a given impact velocity that gives you the highest L over L star value.
Robin, do you have the same rationale for wanting to have a collision here as you did for Earth? Namely, the differentiating material that made up of the Moon versus the Earth. Are the, you know, do you have very different composition between Pluto and Charon?
Well, there are much bigger uncertainties here, but the nominal values place Charon with a significantly lower density than Pluto. But you can make them match at the end of their uncertainty ranges. So the nominal density for Pluto is something like 2, and the nominal density for Charon something like 1.8, with uncertainties of about a tenth, 1.7. So the primary motivation here is actually the angular momentum. It's getting that angular momentum. Oh, we don't know. Oh, the question was, is Charon differentiated? And we don't know. We don't know the moments of inertia of either object.
Will the flyby get that?
Will the flyby get that?
If you're going to get, they are rotating. If you get gravity precisely enough, you get.
Okay. So with that basic logic, I've done an initial series that look at this case of having a collision between two like-size objects. I'm starting here with objects that are about 40% ice, 60% rock. I've assumed in these calculations that the objects are differentiated before the impact. That might or might not be a good assumption depending on each of these objects' own collisional histories. And in this particular simulation, again, the impact velocity is set equal to the escape velocity. And the impact angular momentum is a few tens of percent higher than the nominal value for the Pluto-Charon angular momentum, but that value is also somewhat uncertain. So in this case, after the initial oblique impact, the objects separate, they come back in, and touch is almost like a contact binary for a brief period of time. The cores actually merge. This serves to redistribute angular momentum in the central object, and its outer portions are lifted up. After about 30 hours in this case, I should point out that the resolution in this run is a factor of 3 smaller than the moon-forming impact I've shown you. So this disk actually contains a lot more mass, about 13% of the mass of the central planet in this case. And the remaining angular momentum in this bound planet disk system is comparable to the nominal estimate for the Pluto-Charon system. Well, they're usually clumps. And, you know, if you watch these simulations for some time, you know, the clumps pass within the Roche limit and they get dispersed. And as material goes outside the Roche limit, it'll reclump. You know, there's nothing close to Charon as a clump in that simulation. No. So here's a... What's it, point? Oh, something uncertain. Charon's 0.007.
Very small. Even that is suspect. Even 0.007 is suspect.
Yeah. So these are results from a variety of the same types of impacts I just showed you. And these are considering different initial conditions, different impact velocities, different initial spin states for the colliding objects. And the most consistent result that has emerged from these simulations so far is a basic trend between the mass of that you place into orbit around the planet and the angular momentum of the final planet disk system that you form, ratioed again to the nominal Pluto-Charon value that's somewhat uncertain. And so what these results suggest to date is that to actually form a system that's bound with an angular momentum comparable to that of Pluto-Charon, you also seem to naturally form a pretty massive disk around the central object with, on the order of, so far, about 8 to 13% of the central planet's mass. So these suggest that the most promising type of impact to form Pluto-Charon from a giant impact would be a collision between relatively similar sized objects with low impact velocities corresponding to V at infinity of less than about half a kilometer or so. And they also suggest that the density of Charon is likely lower than the density of Pluto. Okay, so what does this work on impact generation of satellites tell us more generally about planet formation? Namely, it says that the very types of collisions that we think will be typical of late-stage accretion, big impacts at low impact velocities, many of these should also be very efficient producers of satellites. And this suggests that all of the terrestrial planets, maybe even the giant planet cores when they were forming, may have all had these impact-generated satellites. And the eventual fate of these objects could have been determined by later impacts. They could have been disrupted or dislodged. Many of them could have been lost to tidal evolution onto a slow or retrograde orbiting planet. Or, of course, if you were an impact-generated satellite around a giant planet core, you would have been consumed as that core began to undergo runaway gas accretion. So while impacts seem very good candidates for forming large satellites around solid planets, the most promising way of forming large satellites around gas giant planets is this co-formation model.
What was the temperature of the disk in that?
You know, the it's basically on the order of 300 to 400. The delta T in this simulation is on the order of 100, 200, 250.
I just want to make a point that the T over W for this system is 0.28.
Yeah, 0.3.
Bifurcation point between the jack of the ellipsoid.
That's right. And actually, if you see if you notice, the central planet at the end of the simulation is an ellipsoid.
Is the launching material into the Pluto-Charon simulated disk gravitational, or is there significant pressure?
It's all gravitational. The if you compare the specific impact energy to the latent heat of vaporization for ice, there's just very little vaporization with these low impact velocities.
If you put in methane, would that still be true?
Well, it doesn't have that much mass, so I wouldn't think that it would play that big a role.
10% methane.
Yeah, what do you think about?
Well, I mean, even in the case of the Earth-Moon system, you're producing about 20% of the mass in vapor, and yet the torques still seem to dominate. So I think this is really going to be this is more reminiscent of the classical experiments of fission in a rapidly rotating cloud core. I mean, this looks a lot like, in its later stages, these Durison and Tolleen simulations. So I really think it's gravity that's the key player here.
Brody?
Yeah?
Do you think the region of the Pluto-Charon system occurred after capsizing to the switching to red mass to the Neptune body? Because you are assuming the collision velocity is the escape velocity. So if the eccentricity is pumped up very high, then the collision velocity must be very large.
Actually, an abstract. He wants to know whether you think this collision formed before or after it was captured in the Sweden 2. And I actually did an abstract with Jill Hahn several years ago where we pointed out that it's very easy to knock it out of the 3-2 with this kind of an impact. So our guess is that it formed before it was captured.
I mean, you can knock it out and you can put it in a more external place and then recapture it. That upper limit on the infinity for this impact of about half a kilometer per second, that's not far off from the relative velocity you get on Pluto's current orbit, comparing it to a circular velocity at its perihelion versus aphelion. So I don't think this is really constraining that question that well.
Robin, if you knock it out when it's still a low eccentricity and it's outside, then you can recapture it. But if it's high eccentricity, isn't the capture probability small?
Well, of course. Whenever you get a higher eccentricity, your capture probability drops down. Right.
But it's still 10%, even at higher
interest. Yeah, Hal and Alan Stern have a long paper on this, too. Okay, so where was I? Galilean satellites. Okay. So these, of course, are the four large satellites around Jupiter. They have two key constraints that bear on their origin. First is their composition. They have a steady decrease in their density with increasing distance from the planet. This corresponds to them becoming more icy as you move away from the planet. In particular, the outer two, Ganymede and Callisto, are about half rock, half ice. The second key constraint here is that the estimates of Callisto's moment of inertia suggest that this satellite is only partially differentiated, and for a satellite this big to have avoided differentiating into a rock core and an ice mantle means that during its formation, it never underwent a large-scale melting of ice. And given the satellite's mass, in order for that to occur, you have to assume, or you have to suppose, that this satellite formed extremely slowly over a period of 10 to 5 years or greater. And that's a very important constraint because its orbital period around Jupiter is only a couple weeks. So requiring it to have formed over 10 to the 5 years or more is an important constraint.
That's only considering gravitational energy.
Only gravitational energy. What so that's sort of the best case.
What about what we heard before with regard to isotopes? Does that mean that crystals, whatever form of crystal, could not be the same as carbonaceous called a CAI, because the energy released from that would have almost certainly melted.
You mean like aluminum? You mean like aluminum 26?
Yes.
Radioactive heating? Yeah. Well, I don't think having things melted in the asteroid belt implies that process is going to be as active here, because this is going to be displaced in time. This has got to occur at the end of Jupiter's formation, and so aluminum 26 is not going to be a key player at this point. You do have to take care of the radioactive heating in an ongoing way in these satellites to keep them from melting later on. But the starting notion is that you're not forming these objects at 100,000 years after T0 in the solar system. You're forming them near the end of Jupiter's formation.
Let me rephrase the question then. If you form after about 7 million years or 10 million years, how big an object can you still have? There's now residual radioactive isotopes that on this scale will melt in the area.
I don't know the answer to that question.
I think the answer is that if you're relying on K40, UNT35, and so forth, you can accommodate that in a non-strong mixture and connect to the one melt. But actually, that's not clear cut. That's one of these things we can't say we do. You certainly don't have aluminum 26 anymore.
Can't just connect those though, because if you have a lot of water, you don't have really using the environment to do what you gotta do. You don't start the iron from the iron, it's not an iron that would need to be formed.
You differentiate the rock from the
ice, that's the big thing.
Yeah.
The formation of the rock, iron core.
Yeah, the rock. I mean the issue there is, well, there is a chemistry issue as well. Redox issue with chromatin and so forth. But the crucial question is whether you separate rock and iron together from the ice, and then once you've got eventually rock and iron, you can then separate it from using the radioactive heat within that time. But whether you get an iron core is a separate issue again, because that depends on the oxidation state of the iron. And it may require some reduction using carbon species, for example. Because it's not clear that the material is going to actually be important. You do have a lot of sulfur in carbon.
Is that an important constraint for Ganymede, where they're claiming that they're having...
I think we're getting off
Well,
we're supposed to have...
This is a digression that I find very interesting, but it is a digression.
Yeah.
Rather, why don't you continue, and we can digress off the coffee.
Okay. Okay, I won't take too much longer. I'll try to hurry. Okay, so if we assume that the Galilean satellites formed from an accretion disk around a planet, then the mass of the current satellites tells us the minimum amount of solid material, meaning rock and ice, that was involved in forming them. And this corresponds to a solar composition mass of on the order of 2% of the Jovian mass. So the standard starting condition for considering the formation of these objects has been to assume that they form from a disk that contained 2% of a Jupiter mass. And this starting condition is called the minimum mass subnebula model, and it implies a very gas-rich disk with surface densities on the order of 10 to 5 grams per square centimeter. Now, there have been a number of difficulties that have emerged from this basic approach. Namely, this disk is massive enough that it tends to be too hot to allow for ices. The accretion times of these satellites, if you have the material needed to form them all in orbit at one time, are extremely short, on the order of 1,000 years or less, orders of magnitude shorter than that you would need to explain Callisto's partially differentiated state. And finally, in this massive of a gas disk, the lifetimes of these satellites against type 1 interdecay are extremely short, on the order of about 100 years. So given those issues, Bill Ward and I have been pursuing an alternative model in which the satellites form within an accretion disk produced during the very final stages of inflow onto Jupiter. So if you have a situation where the supply to the disk is occurring slowly compared to the disk evolution timescales,
then this 2 times a Jovian mass, this minimum mass, is the minimum amount of material that has to have been processed through the disk, but it doesn't have to have been in the disk all at one time. So we envision a scenario in which gas and solids are being delivered into orbit around Jupiter. The gas has some viscosity and is maintaining a steady state, while the solids are accumulating in the disk and building up over time. And what this model ends up predicting is that the satellites form very slowly in a relatively cool, very low gas surface density disk. And the model seems very promising because it appears to offer a way of reconciling the satellite formation with these basic constraints implied by the satellites themselves. So here's a basic schematic of this model. So we're assuming there's some inflow and that it's characterized by some maximum specific angular momentum, so that the material is going into orbit around the planet in some characteristic region extending from the surface of the planet out to some distance, RC. As I said, the gas is going to, in this situation, is going to spread both onto the planet and out to some outer edge and maintain a steady state, while the solids inflowing to the disk will accumulate. Their accretion times are much shorter than their lifetimes against gas drag, so the solids will increase in the disk. And we consider a simple thermal model for the disk that includes the planet luminosity and viscous heating balanced by radiation off the disk. So the first constraint that emerges is on the rate of the inflow to this disk that must have been occurring during the era of satellite formation. And that emerges because the primary heat source in the disk is viscous dissipation, which means that the effective temperature to the fourth is proportional to the viscosity times the steady state gas surface density. In this steady state situation, sigma gas is proportional to the inflow rate over the viscosity, so that the effective disk temperature is just a function of the inflow rate. So what this means is if you want a disk that has in it temperatures low enough to form icy satellites as opposed to just pure rock satellites, this implies that the inflow to Jupiter when these satellites formed was less than about a Jovian mass per 5 million years. So this suggests that the satellites formed as gas accretion onto the planet was slowing down, and it also implies that the disk had very low gas surface densities. So here are some example disk profiles calculated for, on the top, the case of a more rapid mass inflow to the planet of a Jupiter mass in 10 to the 4 years. On the bottom, a much slower delivery of material to the disk. You can see the temperature profile for the fast inflow case is a lot higher than that needed to have ice stable in the disk, i.e. G and C are the positions of the 4 Galilean satellites. If you look at the slow inflow case, you've got an orders of magnitude lower surface density, something on the order of about 500 grams per cubic centimeter in this, per square centimeter in this case, it should be squared. And the radial profile is now consistent with forming icy satellites. So that's what we think the gas component of the disk looks like. What about the solids? So I mentioned before that we envision that the solids, as they're delivered to the disk, will accumulate and build up in the disk over time. And to illustrate that, we've created a simple satellite accretion model, which considers that there's some inflow of roughly solar composition to the disk. We start off with an initial distribution of satellite tessimals that are much smaller than the Galilean satellites. And then we increase their mass at a rate that's meant to mimic the effect of their accreting material that's being delivered by the inflow. We then track the satellite tessimal accretion with the n-body symbol model, and we analytically include interactions with the gas disk, most importantly, the effect of inward type 1 migration. And I really am almost done here, sorry. Okay, so here is the first of 2 examples I'll show you. In this case, we're going to look at a relatively gas-rich disk, surface density on the order of a few times 10 to the 4 grams per square centimeter. So the animation on the right is going to show us the accretion of these, this initial distribution of satellite decimals down here. The red stars are the current Galilean satellites. The number up at the top is the elapsed time in years. So what you'll see is two basic effects. The mass of these satellite decimals, all these objects, will increase with time in general. That's due to the inflow supply to the disk. And they're also going to be mutually interacting. This is an n-body simulation. And as they collide, it's assumed that they accrete. And so occasionally you'll see two collide and then jump up this plot and reduce the number of satellites. So again, in this case, we're looking at a relatively massive disk. So we see the satellites are growing, they're accreting, and they're migrating in, and they're not going to make it. They're going in. So actually, one thing this model so far is not including is that as these satellites would open regions in the disk where the mass is being delivered, new ones would start to grow. And the addition of those new bodies has not been included in this simulation. But basically, if we have a massive disk, then in something like only about 30,000 years, we've lost the mass of satellites, and they never got up to the size of the Galilean satellites.
Do you think the gas velocity could be the capillary velocity?
You mean the inflow velocity?
No, the gas velocity, when you calculated your type 1 migration.
No, we've got a scale height profile for the disk.
No. The asking usual velocity, is it subcapillary, capillary, or supercapillary?
Well, this is really type 1 decay.
I know, but that depends on whether the velocity is, you know, if the velocity is substantially, say, supercapillary, you could change the thing.
Yeah, but there's a lot more mass in this disk than there is in the inflow. So this is basically just a capillary disk with a small pressure change.
Gas drag's in there.
Gas drag is in there.
Yeah.
Gas drag. I mean, is a solid
gas
in the gas, or a gas
drag
in the solid? That's what I'm asking.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Each of these satellites is still, I mean, even if I looked at it here, they're very small. it's certainly not possible for these satellites to keep the disk moving with them. Okay, their spatial density is not big enough.
What is the total ratio of the total mass in gas versus in solid?
About the same. Yeah.
So this is
towards the end. The beginning is more gas.
Yeah, in the beginning it's gas rich, and that solid to gas ratio is increasing with time. So in this case, the gas surface density is much lower by a couple orders of magnitude. And so in this case, you're able to form a system of satellites. I know, these are kind of endearing to watch. You form a system of satellites that is similar in number and spacing to the Galileans. In something like 170,000 years, containing basically a Galilean satellite system worth of mass. Okay, to sum up what this model would imply for gas giant satellites in general, it would suggest that these satellites formed at the very end of accretion onto the planet, that there was some period of reduced inflow onto the planet, and we're seeing the vestiges of that period. It also suggests that the inward orbital migration of these satellites may likely have occurred. They're fairly large. And that differences that we see in satellite systems may be akin to differences you see in extrasolar systems, because these satellite systems may also have been shaped by migration. And to that end, I'll finish with the same animation I just showed you, but run for a longer period of time. And in this case, the system passes through this Galilean Jupiter-like system at about 170,000 years. But then if you were to assume that the inflow to the disk continued, say until 300,000 years, then it's possible to end up with a system in which you've lost the inner large satellites and can potentially end up with a single large satellite which is more reminiscent of the Saturn system and its large satellite Titan. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Great. Question?
Oh, now you have no questions? Oh, okay. Of course.
Any way you can make the inner Saturnian satellite so icy?
Ooh, good question. I'm thinking about it.
In your Pluto Charon system, you have adopted the assumption the system's total angular momentum is being conserved. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
I think, in fact, Rosemary Martlin had looked at this problem and seems to suggest that it is possible that the system may have actually went through a lot of angular momentum evolution because the orbit of Pluto and Charon are inclined to their mutual orbit around the Sun. Even though the system is relatively well inside the Roche radius, there is a little bit of the cosi, even though it has been suppressed by the apsidal advancement, but things can evolve. And so there is a possibility that the angular momentum of the system may not have been as what we have, you know, how it was formed.
Would that preferentially decrease?
Well, it really does depend on how you start.
I see.
Whether it's possible you can start from large separation and, you know, wind down, or from small separation goes out. But it requires very delicate adjustment of a permanent quadrupole moment. And this is still ongoing work, I think.
Thanks, Todd.
I just have a comment for someone who is not here, and that's Ignacio Mosquera, whose many parts of his models are not very well defendable, but he did have an idea about making the icy inner satellites of Saturn in the sense that the disk was too hot for ice to condense initially, and all of the silicates condensed and migrated inwards and left behind the more volatile materials, including water. But as the disk cooled off, that later condensed, and you have only these tiny satellites because there wasn't much of it left, while leaving Robin's scheme for getting Titan where it is intact.
Robin, you have a question? Speak loud.
Well, there'd be a compositional discrimination too, right? You would expect them to have similar compositions. Right. So I guess the, actually, that was a wonderful paper. I really enjoyed reading it. And of course, you know, as Hal says, to every hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so when I read the paper, I thought, to a man with a hammer, or woman with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I thought, well, this might be a great way of having these low velocity oblique impacts, because some of these pairs, if they get captured in this way, are not going to get stuck at just the right place. Some of them are actually going to mutually collide. Anyway, I guess the main argument so far, and it's not a strong one because I haven't done that many simulations, is that to me, this, you know, forming a system with the right angular momentum and getting something close to the disk mass, that relationship would have to be viewed as coincidental in order for it not to be related to an impact. And maybe it is, but.
Well, we also know that Pluto was hit, because Pluto was heavy. We know collisions happen. That's what accretes.
Yeah, but the only thing we play on today is just one view of it. In that view, the strength happens only after the formation of isolation, so the connecting mass in the outer source of the molecular mass. And that heavy state of the planet formation, we believe that planet will form by doing a very small amount.
Okay, we're suffering from needing a caffeine fix, so it's time for coffee, and we'll be back at 11:10.